This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, where I go deep with the artists, activists, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and visionaries who are making the world more libertarian, or at least more interesting, by championing free minds and free markets. My guest today is Ben Wisner. He's the deputy legal director at the ACLU, and he says that Donald Trump's second term has brought an all-out assault on free speech, targeting comedians, immigrants, universities, and even law firms that take the wrong cases. We put Trump's actions in the context of past presidents, and we discuss whether the ACLU has strayed from the days of defending the free speech rights of American Nazis in Skokie, Unite the Right protesters in Charlottesville, and the National Rifle Association in New York State. We also discuss the legacy of Edward Snowden, whom Wisner worked with, and whether things have gotten better since the whistleblower revealed illegal mass surveillance of Americans. Here is The Reason Interview with Ben Wisner. Ben Wisner, thanks for talking to Reason.
It's my great pleasure, Nick. Thanks for having me.
It is, I want to talk about the ACLU as an organization, but I also want to dive into some really important cases that are going on in the culture, but then also that the ACLU is involved with or has been involved with recently. And I guess let's take the threat temperature level of Donald Trump in his second term to free speech. We're out of the heat of the Jimmy Kimmel moment and things like that, but how do you rate Donald Trump at this point in his second and possibly, second of three terms as president, this type of thing? How bad is he for free speech?
Well, I started at the ACLU a month before the 9/11 attacks in 2001. And I've seen no analog in the 21st century to the kind of threat matrix we see on the free speech front. I think the better analogies are McCarthyism and even possibly the Palmer raids, because you see that they're using really the full power of the state. They are sweeping immigrants off the street for nothing other than their political speech and trying to deport them. They're using all of the funding power of the United States to try to coerce entities into line, including independent universities. They're targeting the legal profession in order to prevent lawyers from taking cases that challenge the Trump administration. They're censoring scientific research. We're really seeing the administration use every lever that it has to try to enforce ideological conformity. That sounds an awful lot like McCarthyism.
Yeah. And well, go back to the Palmer raids real quick, because I think people have a certain sense of McCarthyism. But the Palmer raids, which date back to the 1920s and are, explain what those are.
Yeah. So this was Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer in the fraught years after World War One, when, look, candidly, you had anarchist bombings. You had just had the Bolshevik Revolution that formed the Soviet Union. So the politics were quite fraught at the time. But Palmer essentially did roundups of dissidents, including famously Emma Goldman, who was sent back to Russia, the Soviet Union. And that's the ACLU's origin story. We were formed in 1920, basically in response to those ideological crackdowns that targeted dissidents and immigrants, and again used coercion and detention and deportation authority in order to try to enforce ideological conformity.
And there was no, our understanding. And I was born in 1963, and I grew up. I didn't realize until, in many ways, to the battles over the internet in the 90s, that I had grown up in a weird period of relatively total free speech. I mean, back in the teens, the 20s, certainly in the 40s and 50s, when communism was being hunted down and things like that, we did not take for granted the idea that, the media really was independent of the government.
And a lot, right? So you had the Espionage Act of 1917, the same law that's being used against whistleblowers like Edward Snowden, who I'm sure we'll talk about later. But at that time was being used really to criminalize dissent, target independent media, go after anyone who opposed the U.S.'s war position or Cold War position or First Red Scare position. You're right, though, that a lot of modern First American jurisprudence kind of dates to the Warren Court in the 1960s. I'm going to have to stop saying that out loud. With this Supreme Court, we're going to have to start saying that it dates to Thomas Jefferson, or they won't acknowledge it. So there are good originalist arguments for a strong First Amendment, but many of the doctrines that we rely on right now were first
articulated. And I'm still mad at Earl Warren for interning Japanese Americans or supporting that. So it's like, nobody is good all the way down in terms of like actual civil liberties, it seems.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And again, as I'm sure we'll talk about, finding people who manage to be consistent and to preach the same values regardless of who's being targeted is getting harder and harder.
Before we get to Trump proper, a lot of his supporters say things like, Trump is going after people and he's going after people's speech, but he's basically is just returning the favor of what the Biden administration did. And I don't want to get into a pissing match over which one is worse, but could you, but there is truth that Biden was bad on free speech. How was he bad? And then let's, quantify how much worse Trump actually is.
Well, I think that most Trump partisans who make that claim are referring to something quite specific, which was the efforts, public and private, of the Biden administration to pressure social media companies to take down things like COVID misinformation during the pandemic. Are there other things that they're pointing to?
To be quite honest, the ones who are more serious about this to also talk about free assembly and whatnot under certain types of COVID, COVID policies that were pushed to, where you had lunatic cases where, churches in places like Mississippi could not have drive-in services in public and things like that.
To me, a lot of those critiques are fairly legitimate. Mm-hmm. The question of scale is really what we're talking about here. Those are the kinds of First Amendment intrusions that are routine. I mean, there's no president that I've ever, worked under who didn't violate the First Amendment in one form or another. But I don't think it's fair to say that the Biden administration, mobilized every single lever of its power in order to coerce and go after its adversaries. I mean, we should talk about the so-called jawboning of social media companies. Right. I do think that raises substantial free speech questions. We don't want the government to accomplish indirectly what it can't accomplish directly. It can't directly censor scientific or medical opinions. And so we don't want it to do it indirectly by saying to a social media company, hey, we regulate you. It would be a shame if something happened to you.
Or we regulate other parts of the corporation that runs you or owns you or heavily invests in you. Well, they have things we directly invest or regulate. So, don't mess with us.
Candidly, I don't think the evidence that was presented to the Supreme Court in the Missouri versus Murthy case, which is where this came up, was all that persuasive. It didn't show that kind of coercive threat. I mean, what we saw with the FCC and Jimmy Kimmel was a government regulator saying, do you want to do this the easy way or the hard way? There was nothing like that in the record in Missouri versus Murthy.
And we can also, as long as I'm taking your side completely in this moment, the laws that came out of things like, the jawboning, you had states like Texas and Florida saying, we are going to regulate the business models of social media platforms in order to make sure that the people we think are on our side are not screwed over by anything. Those are all in abeyance now, right?
Because they sued, we supported them in the Supreme Court. And this is one of those times where I think free speech law and free speech values are not perfectly aligned.
Right.
So we took the side of the social media companies and we said, Texas and Florida can't tell you what kind of speech you ought to host. On the other hand, we don't think you should be censoring political speech. We think you should take a very lenient approach to political speech if you want to hold yourselves out as platforms for public debate. And that's why the ACLU was critical of the platforms, even for deplatforming Trump after the January 6th events, when everyone was calling for that and when they did that under pressure, because we thought that Trump's participation there was newsworthy and the people had a need to see it and that those companies should not be responding to that kind of pressure to do that. Right. So in any event, look, I don't think these things are close to equivalent, and that is in no way a defense of some of the misguided decisions that the Biden administration made under pressure.
Can we we'll talk about the FCC in particular in a second, but you brought up a kind of larger question of a culture of free speech, yeah. Because in the end, we've had the same constitution, or we've had the same First Amendment since the beginning of the country, but it really only became a serious defense of people being able to say whatever the fuck they wanted, including using dirty words, like sometime really in the 1960s and 70s. There was a huge battle that I think, when the internet was booming or was starting to come online, and people in government, both, Republicans and Democrats, wanted to regulate it like a broadcast network, a wide array of free speech voices, from progressives to liberals to libertarians to some conservatives, were like, no way.
Right. And that famous case was ACLU versus Reno.
That's right.
This is the Magna Carta of the internet, where the government said, let's use the same rules we use for radio. And we said, no, books and magazines.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, sadly, I remember talking to Michael Powell, the old FCC commissioner in the early aughts, and he was like, he was saying, yeah, there's two standards for speech, and the FCC really, or broadcast, should definitely migrate to the standard for print. That hasn't happened, but more broadly, are we, part of what conservatives often talk about when they're like, okay, now it's payback time. We were in the wilderness for 4 years, and wokeness and other types of speech codes that may not have been laws, but were custom or tradition, or, the culture of free speech had been crushed to where you could no longer say whatever you wanted. Where are we in that broader culture of free speech? And again, this isn't to defend conservatives, but it seems like, compared to, when the PMRC was talking about, wanting to put advisory labels on dirty lyrics and satanic lyrics, and Al Gore was holding Senate hearings about this, everybody seemed to laugh at that on a certain level. But then again, the advisory labels went up, they were voluntary, whatever. But, I'm just trying to get at, like, where are we, do you think, is a culture of free speech? Because it seems like more people don't want to hear things they don't want to hear, and they want to use the government at some level to make sure that this stuff is blocked out.
It's very hard to say. I think if we were talking a few years ago, we would be talking about how we could make persuasive arguments to the left and progressives that free speech values are important to them, and that they shouldn't try to enlist government power to silence opponents. Now there is huge support for free speech rights among progressives and the left, because they're seeing how it's being used to go after Palestinian human rights and so on. So, I mean, I'm trying out a new talking point. Let me know how it goes. Okay. So here's what I say. Most people think two things about free speech, and they're wrong about both. Okay. They think they know what it is, and they think they support it. They don't know what it is, and they don't support it. The only way that you can show me or persuade me that you support it is the moment when you stand up to defend speech that deeply offends you. And until you're willing to do that, I just don't believe you that you support it. And so you see it. Everyone can legitimately make a claim of hypocrisy in any moment. But you see how the sides flip. You had Republicans in Congress clamoring about snowflakes on campus. And now they're hauling college presidents in front of a McCarthyite committee and saying, how come you're not cracking down on speech more? So if you want to level the hypocrisy charge, you can level it against almost everybody in our society.
Well, except for the two of us, I think.
Well, us and fire.
It's a small group, and the conversations generally are kind of boring after a certain point.
The other point that I want to make about this is that, doctrinally, in terms of the law as articulated by the Supreme Court and the lower courts, we're really at a high watermark for free speech protection. And yet, we've never seen more violations. And that's sort of the paradox always of free speech law, which is that we're not going to court to change the way the court views free speech law. We're going to court to enforce the First Amendment in all of these cases. But it's not a law reform project, it's a law enforcement project.
How long can the culture of free speech, or rather the legal status of free speech, because we have had, really for half a century, virtually uninterrupted string of, when it comes before the courts, speech can be a little more free or a little less free. Tends to be a little more free, even commercial speech, which is fascinating. But how long can that consensus hold up if we don't have a culture of free speech where, you know, the quote that is often, you know, apocryphally attributed to Voltaire about, you know, I'll defend your right to say whatever they want, even though I disagree with you. I mean, how, you know, can we maintain a legal status that supports free speech if people are like, you know what, like, I really don't like free speech?
Apparently we can.
Yeah.
More than I would have thought, because I don't think this, again, double standards for free speech, I don't think that's new. I think we're seeing a lot more force being applied here. But I think this free speech for me and not for thee describes how most people, including most people in power, have approached this question, you know, for my lifetime. And sort of somehow the courts have stood above this and applied these principled standards and said, wait a minute, even if you think that you could articulate the right rule, why do you trust who's going to be enforcing that rule? This is what I would always say to people who wanted speech codes or something like that. Yeah. Like, didn't Trump winning in 2016 cure you of that? When, you know, he's going to be sitting at the top of that enforcement chain. You really want to give the government power to regulate misinformation when Trump deems fake news anything that doesn't toe his line? Are you sure about that? Yeah. But somehow it doesn't fully break through. You know, it's that adage that I forget about having to fight the battle over and over again.
Yeah, it's very Sisyphean and annoying. I mean, you know, Camus imagined Sisyphus happy or smiling. I think of him as grousing, you know, having to go to work every day. Let's talk at least briefly about Jimmy Kimmel and the FCC. And this was an outrageous moment where, you know, on Benny Johnson's podcast, and if anybody has more owes more to unfettered free speech without any kind of legal sanction against him, it's Benny Johnson, a serial fabulist and plagiarist and just a bullshit artist. Like, he's one of the supreme bullshit artists of our moments. He has Brendan Carr on, the head of the FCC, the chairman, saying we can do this the easy way or the hard way. If Disney and ABC don't start, you know, policing Jimmy Kimmel and people like him, you know, there's going to be trouble. What have we learned from this episode? Kimmel is back, et cetera. But like, you know, what do we learn from this episode?
So we've learned a few things. The first is probably not a reason talking point, but it is that those who worried about corporate control of important media entities were right. They're being vindicated, because what we have are these news organizations that are part of much larger companies that have business interests that are much more important than their news arms, that are therefore subject to all kinds of leverage and pressure by the government, and will make important decisions that bear on the public interest for reasons that have nothing to do with media values. We learned something else, which is the value to public debate of this kind of really crude overreach. The reversal, we like to take credit for it because of our advocacy and our getting hundreds of celebrities to sign a letter and so on. So you could point to Disney stock price falling, you know, something like 10%, millions of people canceling subscriptions to Hulu and others. And then also, I mean, just the irony that Trump, whose political success is due to being a comedian himself, is now assuming the role of the censor of comedians, which is not a comfortable political role here. But, I think it was a really important moment, one of the most important moments in the administration, another one was Harvard choosing to sue, regardless of how that gets resolved, rather than capitulating, showing that you have to model this kind of resistance. Don't give the president power he doesn't have. I have no doubt that Trump is less popular as a result of what he tried to do with Kimmel than he was before.
That's to the broad swath, the vast majority of Americans who did not vote for Donald Trump and have not watched late night TV of any stripe for, 50 years or something like that. If I may, just to go back to the reason point, I think part of, I ended up writing a piece called Abolish the FCC for the Free Press. And the reason why I bring that up, not just to toot my own horn, but also, the reports are now that the Free Press is being bought by, effectively is going to be, Barry Weiss is going to be given the editor-in-chiefship of CBS News, which then is part of an entity that is regulated by the FCC. And so that means, you know, to your point, this is what happens, where does that means now that the free press, because it is owned, if it's owned by Skydance, which then owns a bunch of regulated properties, like the FCC can be like, hey, you know what, I really didn't appreciate that piece in the free press, and you have a merger coming up. I mean, that's what's lurking behind all of this stuff.
And of course, the other problem here is, look, I think that the kind of coercion that the FCC put on ABC was unconstitutional jawboning. Right. It was what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
If the government can't lock up Jimmy Kimmel for his speech, it can't push him off the air by pressuring ABC. But the only one who could challenge that in court would be ABC, right, or Jimmy Kimmel. Right. And if they don't, right? Yeah. So if the free press doesn't challenge that, then, you know, we have no way of bringing what is really a substantial First Amendment violation before the court. So you're seeing...
Right. Well, that is the problem with Murthy v. Missouri, right? It's that, among anything else, the Supreme Court didn't actually have to deal with any hard issues because they just said the people bringing the case didn't have standing.
I think with the court's ruling there, if you read it more closely, they were saying that they didn't regard the facts there as presenting a serious First Amendment issue, because I think the standing inquiry and the First Amendment inquiry are very closely related. I know that's not how the plaintiffs are choosing to read it.
Yeah.
You know, you're seeing something similar with the university. So Columbia, for example, unlike Harvard, just decided to sign on the dotted line. So you see professors through the American Association of University Professors bringing a lawsuit saying, hey, this is jawboning. This is aimed at our speech.
Right.
And they're going after Columbia to get at us. So we should have standing to go into court.
Yeah.
And challenge this deal, which is manifestly illegal. And we'll see if that kind of strategy succeeds. So far, it hasn't.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously Trump is also, he's gone after specific, or he's gone after networks for specific shows. I mean, the most insane thing is the 60 Minute, you know, the getting into the editing room of a 60 Minutes episode, you know, interview with Kamala Harris, who he beat. It, you know, this is horrible, various law firms, you know, because of the people that they represented. This, I mean, he is clearly doing a textbook case, or his administration, the kind of cloud of people around him. This is a chilling effect on speech, or it's a temptation.
Let's talk about the law firms, because I think the law firms are a perfect example there. So Trump targeted a number of law firms with executive orders. Anyone who has even walked past a law school, much less gone in, knows that these orders are completely illegal. Four law firms chose to challenge them. Four different federal judges spanning the ideological spectrum basically laughed the Trump administration out of court in these cases and said, this is the most unconstitutional thing we've ever seen. And yet, a bunch of other law firms dutifully trudged down to Washington, got into the room with Trump and Boris Epstein, signed or pretended to sign deals, and many other law firms who weren't targeted but who didn't sign deals, they're the real audience for this. They're the real targets for this.
Right.
Who wants to be the law firm that puts its head up and says, we are, under our own name, challenging the Trump administration? Now, many are still. Yeah. And so, you know, I think ultimately this is not going to be a fully effective strategy. So maybe they don't put their names on an amicus brief. They're still doing work, and others have stepped forward. But the idea here is the chill, not winning the case.
That's right.
They knew they couldn't win the case.
So does the chill work, I guess is what I'm asking, or does it create, you know, this is, Robert Korn Revere, who's, you know, now at FIRE, a longtime First Amendment, there had a great book that came out a couple of years ago called The Eye of the Mind of the Center, and or I have obviously lost the title, but one of the things that he pointed out, and it's a great history of censorship in the U.S., is that the censor always ends up becoming a ridiculous figure that gets overrun by free speech. That might be a little bit too sunny right now, but does the attempt to chill free speech, you know, do you think it will work, or do you think it will raise up the ire of people who are like, fuck it, I'm Spartacus and I'm going to watch Jimmy Kimmel, or I'm going to leave my TV on so that he gets ratings, even if I'm asleep?
both. And I think what you're seeing in the legal profession is a bit of a division between the corporate lawyers who are more on the business side, who are doing transactions, who have law degrees, but they're really into mergers and so on. And they're the ones who are less likely to want to stand up for the values of the profession. And then the litigators who have identities beyond their paychecks, who are saying, we're going to leave these law firms and start new law firms, or we're not going to go to these firms if we're early in our careers and do that. And I do think, you know, most people who are not ideologically committed would rather be on the winning side. Right. And so the importance of these challenges is to cast some doubt among those people about who is going to be the winning side. And I think one of the interesting things you saw Democrats do in the last few weeks in Congress is say, hey, we're going to do some investigation into these secret deals that law firms are forming with the Trump administration to see really what's going on here. And, you know, maybe they'll get the gavel back and they'll be able to do that. But I think the message is what's important. Maybe the cost of compliance is higher than you thought. Yeah. Maybe the cost of resistance is lower than you thought. And that's how, you know, we filed 85 lawsuits against the Trump administration. Now, obviously, we filed them because we want to win, but we filed them because we also want to model resistance and to show that kind of fearlessness.
You know, after 9/11, you had mentioned that you started at the ACLU just before that. John Ashcroft, who is, I'm sure you feel this way. You're younger than me, but it's the same thing of like, these were the battles that were fought every minute of every day for a decade or more. And then you struggle to remember what they were about and whatnot. But John Ashcroft famously after 9/11 and after the Patriot Act passed, he said, you know, he didn't want to hear from, you know, from fake Americans, essentially, who were trying to scare people with phantoms of lost liberties. Because we were in a global war on terror and we had to lock it down and we, you know, all speed, you know, loose lips sink ships, that kind of thing. He and the Bush administration, and to a certain degree, a lot of people in Congress, regardless of party, you know, were invoking this, you know, that we are at war, you know, and we, you know, we have to lock down free expression. What is there something similar that the Trump administration is trying to say, this is the threat that our muscular actions against free speech is designed to help? Or is it just, you know, I am Trump, and if you annoy me or any of my kind of, you know, Batman 66 level villains, you know, I'm going to come after you. That it's
so interestingly, they are invoking war, invasion, national security, emergency, but not in the context of their crackdowns on free speech. They're doing it to justify mass deportation. They're doing it to justify tariffs, right?
It's nuts.
Really wild.
It's a national emergency,
But on speech, it seems like the villain that they're trying to slay is wokeism. Or I guess you could say sometimes anti-Semitism is being used as the main pretext for these kinds of
Getting confusing.
Gender ideology is another villain that has to be wiped out. Diversity. And so like you're seeing these government-wide efforts to take down any web page that even has those words that leads to some comical results because they're not always about what the Stephen Miller Crusaders think that they are about.
But you have to get rid of any web page that, you know, that talks about Jackie Robinson is obviously a national security threat at this point.
Again, they're not using national security in this particular context. You know, this is a different frame they're using, but they are absolutely abusing. You know, I mean, Trump has invoked an 18th century statute to declare a Venezuelan gang that you had probably never heard of at war with the United States so that he can try to deport people en masse without any kind of due process or legal process. Right. And now, yesterday we learned that he has informed Congress that we are in an armed conflict with drug gangs, allowing him to fire missiles at any ship thousands of miles away from the U.S. As a legitimate military target,
Well, you know, there is the immigration specter of, you know, both, and I want to talk about some of the cases that the ACLU has been involved in that have to do with students on campus who, you know, have written or, you know, signed on to op-eds that are, you know, that somehow insult Trump. So they want to get rid of them. But also in something like Guevara versus Francis, Let's talk about that case a little bit, because this seems to be part of it. The invasion that is not, you know, it's not Al-Qaeda, it's not ISIS, it may not even be MS-13 or Venezuelan gangs. It is immigrants are here and we need to, we have been overrun by, you know, I've heard estimates as high as 40 million illegal immigrants came during the Biden years because he just opened the border. And, you know, this is patently untrue. And it's not to say there aren't, you know, legitimate issues about border control and things like that. But it seems to be that if you are a Latino or if you are Middle Eastern or if you have sympathies with certain things, you are under a heightened scrutiny for what you're doing. Can you talk about the Guevara v. Francis case?
Because yeah, so Mario Guevara, so he is someone, he's not a citizen. He's been in this country for two decades. He's a journalist. And what he does is video journalism of the immigration system. And this is someone who has developed close friendships with law enforcement and ICE agents over the years, because he's just in the system and he's around. And in this case, he was filming ICE activities, you know, related to Trump's mass deportation regime. And he was arrested and locked up expressly because of those activities. And they said the reason why he couldn't be released was because of his journalism. I mean, it couldn't have been more blunt as a First Amendment violation. So at the same time, he's in removal deportation proceedings. The Trump administration is trying to send him back to El Salvador, where he's from. The ACLU stepped in to file a habeas corpus petition saying, separate and apart from whatever grounds you might have for removing him, it is clearly a First Amendment violation to lock someone up because of their speech, right? And that the courts have to deal separately with the question of whether he can be detained from whether he can be removed. That argument did work in the Mahmoud Khalil case, in the Ramesa Ozturk case, in the Mohsen Madawi case. But in this case, the courts in Georgia did not take jurisdiction for the purpose of really adjudicating our habeas corpus claim. And either yesterday or today, the news is that Mr. Guevara, who has U.S. citizen children, including one child who has a brain tumor, is being deported to El Salvador. And I think that there are some of the claims he'll be able to continue to pursue from there, and maybe he will eventually be able to adjust his status and come back here. But this was really a transparent attempt to go after a critic.
Yeah, to be clear, he entered the country legally under under a work visa that expired years ago, but then he was in the process where,
adjusting his status. Yes.
Yeah, and he had been, you know, his deportation orders had been stayed. He was, according to the judges in the case, he was not a threat to flee. He should have been released on bond or, you know, certainly not deported. And this is where it gets complicated, right? Because this is, if he was a citizen, or he would not be deported, most likely.
Right.
If he was on a green card or had a clear legal status, maybe, maybe not.
Well, Mahmoud Khalil has a green card. I think they didn't know that when they showed up to arrest him. That seems to be the case. They showed up in the vestibule of his building on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and said, "We're revoking your visa." He said, "I'm not here on a visa." And they said, "Hold on," got on the phone and said, "We're revoking your green card." Well, they can't revoke a green card. Only a court can do that. But they continued to, they detained him for over 100 days, and they are trying to remove his green card on the ground that his non-criminal free speech interfered with Secretary Rubio's foreign policy prerogatives, right? And then they made up a fake argument later that he misled them on his green card application because he didn't say that he was going to later be involved in specific kinds of
pro-Palestinian
in the future.
Advocacy.
In the future.
Well, I don't want to slide from one to the other, but Guevara and I barely speak English, so I mispronounce people's names, and I apologize for that to anybody who might be offended by it. But has he been deported? I mean, we're talking on October 2nd. I'm not sure when this will air, or he is about to be deported.
I don't know the answer to that because I didn't get an up to the minute. I suspect that by the time anybody hears this or views this podcast, the answer will be yes.
Yeah. And then the question, I mean, there are two questions. One is a legitimate one about immigration policy, because this is something else that the Trump administration is consistently pushing on and saying, well, whatever you know, whatever happened under the Biden administration or previous administrations, maybe even Trump's first term, that doesn't matter now. And they're saying things like, you know, parole and asylum systems were abused. So we're just getting rid of people. I mean, this is a serious battle that has to do with immigration procedure. But above and beyond any of that, the case here in terms of free speech is that this guy was clearly being singled out.
Absolutely.
Because he was speaking in ways that the government did not like.
And to be clear, the government has not denied that. Right. Yeah. And that's what makes these, you know, these precedents so chilling, which is the government is not saying, oh, that's not why we're detaining him. They, in fact, said that was why they were detaining him. They're on record saying that. And you know, they assert that they have that authority. Now, you know, you go to the more general point about their immigration policy. Look, no president has ever tried to do deportation on the scale that Trump is doing it. That's not because they couldn't. Right. It's because for various reasons they didn't. You know, maybe because of values, maybe because of human rights, maybe because of the economy. Maybe, you know, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California and the agricultural economy of California depended on immigration. And so, it is true that there are probably millions of people in the country who don't have necessarily great defenses against legal process. The problem for the Trump administration is law and due process. Mm-hmm. That even people who don't necessarily have a right to be here have a right to make a case, to say I'm entitled to asylum, to say I'm entitled to adjust status. And that creates inefficiencies. And so what they're trying to do is get around those inefficiencies. And that's why you see them invoking things like invasions, alien enemies, because they think that if they can get that legal frame, they can just herd hundreds or thousands of people onto buses and onto planes without having to stop at a courthouse. So far, the Supreme Court has given them a stop sign there. Yeah. Even on their emergency docket, this case has been up to the Supreme Court twice, and twice the Supreme Court has said, slow down. We have to first consider whether the Alien Enemies Act was properly invoked. Mm-hmm. And then, even if it was, what process people are entitled to show that they're not a member of that gang.
Right.
So the court has so far at least stood up for due process without weighing in on the scope of the president's authority. The Bill of Rights is an anti-efficiency manifesto.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Due process is its inefficient.
Best. Yeah. Yeah.
Inefficient.
I mean, the one thing I would just say briefly that, you know, there's a case that under President Eisenhower and, you know, the Operation Wetback in the late 50s, which deported hundreds of thousands of people, including many American citizens who were swept up in raids and things like that, did take place. And, you know, in a way, early on or in the campaign, Trump was invoking that sometimes, or people around him as like, okay, this is what we can do it. And, you know, among other things, he failed to understand that beyond everything else, that was such a disaster, both economically for the country, but also in public relations. And I guess my question to you, it's similar with immigration, a kind of policy and speech policy. There is a culture of free speech and there is the law. Trump is going to lose on the legal merits of this stuff. But then do you feel like, you know, is the culture of immigration or the culture of the idea that America, you know, people don't want illegal aliens who are here who are committing crime. And Trump said, hey, I'm going after the bad guys. I'm not going to start raiding chicken processing plants. But when he starts going after college students because they wrote an article that might have been seen by like 100 people in a student newspaper, that seems like it's going to prove unpopular.
I think if they had restricted themselves to going after people who had criminal convictions, it probably would have maintained majority public approval. It's been interesting to see that Trump is considerably underwater in public opinion polls, even on immigration
especially on immigration. I mean, it's actually and this happened in his first term. The more explicitly anti-immigrant he got, you could see reliably people, you know, agreeing that immigrants are pretty good for the country.
And I don't think that's only because they are doing ideological targeting and going after students who didn't commit crimes. It's because they're also going after the poultry plants, even though they said they weren't going to. And they're going after lots of businesses. They can't hit their numbers. They can't hit a million a year. Yeah. if they're just going to go after people who have felony convictions.
Oh, and when you hear, right. you know, every day you read stories about people, it's, you know, say a husband with a child who are both American citizens, and they're accompanying the mother and wife to, you know, with their lawyer going to work on immigration issues, and then the person gets arrested and separated from the family. Like nobody is in favor of that.
We have filed a lawsuit. I hope it will succeed against these kinds of courtroom arrests, because again, mm-hmm. you want to encourage compliance with the legal system, not non-compliance. I mean, it's sort of why local governments really hate being dragooned into immigration enforcement.
Right.
You know, if you're the police, you don't want people in your community afraid to report crimes. Yeah. If you're public health officials, you don't want them afraid to come to hospitals, right? I mean, that actually threatens everybody's public safety. And so it's not because these sanctuary cities, you know, are all run by leftist nuns. Right. It's because actually it's hard to run a local government if everyone thinks that everyone in the government is going to arrest them, detain them, and deport them. And it's a significant public health risk.
Let's talk about a case that is all of the ACLU cases are adjacent to one another to the extent that they're about the Bill of Rights, in particular about civil liberties. The NRA took a certain amount of heat from chapters within the ACLU or state chapters, but NRA versus Vulo. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that
correct.
Okay, but maybe I assume that's an Italian name. I don't know, so maybe I'm more familiar with it. But what was going on in NRA v. Vulo, and where does it stand now?
So here's what was alleged: the NRA filed a lawsuit against the Andrew Cuomo administration in New York, and Vulo was the insurance commissioner under Cuomo. And the NRA alleged, and the facts in their complaint are deemed true when they allege this, that the Cuomo administration, through Vulo, Commissioner Vulo, had called up the NRA's banks and insurance companies and given some version of this, like, hey, we're doing a bunch of investigations into you. We could stop. Why are you providing services to the NRA? Right. Things would be a lot easier for you if you were not providing banking and insurance services to the NRA. And because we don't like the NRA's advocacy of gun rights. Mm-hmm. And
this is also against the backdrop of New York State's gun control laws broadly being viewed as, you know, as unconstitutional.
In the same vein and separately, the Attorney General of New York had brought a case against the NRA, saying that because of alleged corruption of its leadership, it should lose its nonprofit status altogether and not be able to incorporate. That seemed to us like the wrong remedy. Mm-hmm. If the members are the ones being defrauded by their leaders, why should the remedy be to dissolve the organization? It should be targeted at the leaders who are defrauding the members. But in any event, in this case, the NRA was the plaintiff. They prevailed in a lower court. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals reversed and said even if the NRA's allegations were true, it didn't present a First Amendment problem. And at that point, the NRA reached out to the ACLU. We had filed an amicus brief in the lower court and said, you know, would you consider representing us in the Supreme Court? As you point out, these decisions can be polarizing inside an organization like the ACLU. Our commitments are to civil liberties. Our staff, our members tend to lead progressive. But the senior leadership of the organization was unequivocally committed to doing this. And the NRA was represented in the Supreme Court by David Cole, who at that time was our national legal director, the top lawyer in the organization. And the Second Circuit had ruled 3-0 against the NRA. The Supreme Court ruled 9-0 in favor of the NRA in this case. And I do think that there was more than symbolic importance in having the ACLU put its prestige on the line in this case. Yep. But this is the classic jawboning case. This is the classic case, again, we've talked about this already today, that you cannot accomplish indirectly what you're not permitted to accomplish directly. The goal here was to make life difficult for the NRA because of its advocacy of gun rights and the fact that they were using regulatory levers to do that. Now, to be clear, the NRA still has to prove this case. So the stage that this was at was at a sort of motion to dismiss case. And in technical terms, that means that the courts had to assume that the allegations were true and then decide what the legal implications were. The Supreme Court essentially said, if what the NRA has alleged is true and it happened this way, that is a significant First Amendment violation. And now the case is returned to lower courts where the NRA has to develop the factual record to prove that that happened. So it, in a sense, the NRA could still lose the case, but the precedent is one of the most important precedents. It's being cited in virtually every single First Amendment challenge under the Trump administration. And I will say that there are many people within the ACLU who were skeptical of our involvement, who have said very kind things. And, you know, in light of later developments,
because it clarifies, you know, both what it means, what jawboning really means at its worst, or the idea that government will use indirect ways to achieve that, goals.
And also, it's just an incredibly clear statement that the government cannot single out viewpoints for regulatory pushback or pressure. So it's a very clear statement of that principle.
So the ACLU, you know, got a little bit, or not a little bit, but got substantial pushback from within its organization for representing the NRA. And this puts me in mind, I want to get your sense of this. You know, starting about a decade ago when the NRA represented or defended the right of the people who put together the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, which ended up in a murder.
You mean the ACLU?
The ACLU
of Virginia.
Okay, the ACLU. And when the Charlottesville rally turned violent, it seemed to create a moment within the ACLU of saying, you know, we are representing the wrong people at various points. There was a leaked memo in 2018, which seemed to suggest that the ACLU was, some people in the ACLU wanted to get away from this idea that we are going to be doing cases strictly based on procedural issues, not on content-based things. And the ACLU seemed to lose its mojo a little bit. It was talking a lot about issues that were subsidiary or deemed by critics anyway, some within the organization, some who had been in the organization, just subsidiary to like basic free speech rights and civil liberty rights. Are you guys back? Because like everything that you've been talking about today, it's like, and the types of cases and the way that you're talking about them, this seems like the ACLU I remember from my childhood that was defending the rights of idiot Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. And you know, the ACLU where, and I'm sure, I mean, you're obviously too young for this, but when George H.W. Bush, you know, said, I think he-
I'm not too young for this.
Okay, impugned
I'm
Michael.
I'm born in 1971, a card-carrying member of the ACLU.
And it's like, my God, like I could just imagine your development officers being like, oh, cha-ching. But that, you know, that, and it does come down oftentimes, you said this at the very beginning, it is about defending the rights of people that you do not share ideological commitments with. That's what civil liberties is all about. That's the greatest tradition of the ACLU. So, I mean, has your organization gone through, a phase now where it is like back, baby, and better than ever?
So, this was very interesting. I did a lot of digging into our history around the time of the Charlottesville conflict and brouhaha. And as you say, I'm not going to deny it, there was significant churn within the organization and a lot of staff members who said, every case we do is a choice. We're an organization of limited resources. Every time you choose to represent a white supremacist in Charlottesville, you are by definition choosing not to represent someone else. Right. So why don't you let someone else do that work? Even if we don't disagree doctrinally that they have the right to march.
We want to do what we want to do. There's an infinite number.
So I found this article from the New York Times in the 1970s by the famous journalist J. Anthony Glucas, 5,000 words in the Times Magazine, the ACLU against itself. This was before Skokie. Yeah. 5,000 words about how the ACLU was tearing itself apart because some people objected to the ACLU representing the Klan in cases and Southern affiliates and some were for it. So I think these internal battles are as old as the organization. It's never been non-controversial within the ACLU, and the ACLU has always nonetheless done that work. Now, I think where there are cycles is, you know, there's a zeitgeist outside the organization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously there was a strong, you know, progressive zeitgeist in the era around Charlottesville and in 2020 with George Floyd and all that, where, we're not immune. Our staff is not immune to what's going on in the culture and what's going on in the politics. And so the other thing about the ACLU, unlike an organization like FIRE, which is a single issue First Amendment organization, is that, and this isn't new, we've always done work on racial equality. We've always done work on prisoners' rights, on capital punishment, right, on abortion rights, on marriage equality. We filed our first marriage equality case in 1971, right? So this work isn't new within the ACLU, but I think what ended up happening with increased polarization is at least a lot of the public communications around that work, you know, ended up looking so progressive coded in our culture that people didn't look past that to see that, hey, actually the ACLU is still doing cases like NRA v. Vulo. And, you know, if you want to see this all in one place, David Cole, you know, wrote a blog post, you know, defending the speech we hate, where, you know, he sort of collected this year by year and said, like, we've never stopped doing it. It's you know, maybe there are times when it wasn't emphasized as much as other work that the ACLU was doing that seemed to some to be not core civil liberties, as you might put it, but supported our equality mission as well. You know, are we back? I think, look, I would say, you know, at a moment like this, strong support for free speech is not controversial almost anywhere in the free speech community or in the civil rights or civil liberties community. So I think we'll know how back we are when, you know, there's another progressive president or a moment like that where the Trump threat is out of the way and we're doing these kinds of cases. And look, we'll see. I mean, I don't want to signal something that hasn't happened yet, but you know, in the next weeks, you know, we will be filing briefs in support of speech rights for people whose views are deeply offensive to many people in the ACLU community.
Can you be more specific about that?
I don't want to on this one, just because I don't want to preview this one. But look, the ACLU of Ohio recently filed a case on someone who was expelled from a public law school because of speech that was deemed as celebrating the killing of the Israeli embassy staff we took on that case. I mean, so you know, you can always, I don't want to give you a Pollyannish view and say, hey, there's nothing to see here. No, like, these tensions are essentially always exist within the ACLU to some degree or another. And there are moments like after Charlottesville where they really spill out.
Yeah. And do you have a sense, I guess, within the kind of ACLU liberal or progressive community, is there a sense that wokeness, however we want to define that, or the idea, in the same way that conservatives now seem to be saying, or people in the Trump MAGA orbit are saying, like, shut up about your personal causes, or if you're uncomfortable with something the Trump administration is doing because we're at war and we have to present a united front against everything. There seem to be moments, you know, leading into the 2020 election, but then after COVID and after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and whatnot, where progressives did not talk as much or argue as much among themselves and were presenting a kind of unified front to say, we need to be doing this and we need to be stopping dissent among our own ranks. Do you have a sense that within the broader ACLU community, or liberals or progressives, I'm not sure if you identify with either of those terms, are people like, oh, you know what, we lost our way there because we're never, you know, we're never going to be trying to undercut one another, but, like, we really need to, you know, remain committed to certain ideals that are very hard to hold up, you know, at a particular moment in time?
I really hesitate to speak for others here, but I will say, I think there is a real kind of popular front, all hands on deck vibe right now. I think people really do regard these threats as potentially existential to rights and liberties. And in that context, what you're basically seeing is just, you know, unequivocal support for the heroic work that's being done. And look, it helps that the most important free speech cases that the ACLU is doing right now are the cases on behalf of students who are being targeted for their speech and being detained and deported for that. I mean, like that's never going to be controversial inside the ACLU community.
Is there any analog? I'm just thinking, when I was in college and grad school in the 80s mostly, and, you know, then the big issue was divestment from South Africa, probably more than anything, as well as a lot of criticism of the Reagan era foreign policy in Central America. But the idea that students would be canceled or kicked off of campus for whatever they wrote, including, there were always hard right people who were very unpopular. But then the idea that, you know, if somebody supported, the Sandinistas or CISPIS in El Salvador, the idea that like that would be an offense where you would be deported. It just seemed totally foreign to the conversation.
I think that what's different is that those issues didn't really divide campuses the way the Gaza war has. You didn't have powerful interests on both sides of those issues. I mean, it was some students against the university and the other students weren't paying attention. Yeah. Whereas here, you really do have kind of raw conflict on a lot of these campuses. And then you have powerful alums whose kids go to the school and who are really offended by what they're seeing and are using that authority and that power that they have in order to sort of push for particular responses, withhold their donations. Mm-hmm. It is a little different than the disputes, over divestment in our time or, when I was in college, it was living wage for workers on campus, which was people were hunger striking for that, which struck me as a very wonderful thing for students to use their power for. So in that sense, I think it's a different a different magnitude of challenge.
Let's talk. You at an earlier stage of your career, you were doing legal work, or you were Edward Snowden's legal advisor. I want to ask two quick questions about him. And the first is, he is, one of the great heroes in American history. I choke up even saying his name, and who put everything on the line to reveal, illegal mass surveillance of Americans. And my first question is, where are we on that kind of question? We know that the Trump administration is going after people. We know that, Obama was a liar when he said he had the most transparent administration ever, and that, Trump didn't do much to, change that trajectory, or Biden or whatever, on like deep state data collection. But what is going on with the types of programs that Edward Snowden revealed to us? Is it happening, but in a different way, or has it actually been reformed and changed?
I mean, the first thing I want to say is that he admires you as well. When I told him I was going to be coming on your show, he wanted me to send warm regards. So I know that you've spoken to him in the past, and he's grateful that you keep him in mind. So look, his revelations did lead to pretty extraordinary and unprecedented changes. One of the first things that President Obama said when Snowden came forward is, hey, Americans, don't worry about this. These programs were approved by all three branches of government. But of course, that wasn't a defense. That was the problem. That had been done in secret without any public consultation, without any public approval. And soon thereafter, sort of stung by sunlight, all three branches of government had to change course on this. And so, we had never been able to get intelligence surveillance cases into court because the argument always went, you don't have standing unless you can show it affects you. You can't show that it affects you because it's a secret program, and therefore you don't have standing and no one else has standing, right? After Snowden produced records that showed that the ACLU, among others, had its phone records collected by the NSA on a daily basis, we had a ticket to federal court and were able to get a court to say that the first program revealed by Snowden, the mass call record surveillance program, was illegal and had always been illegal. By the same token, Congress, passed the USA Freedom Act, which was the first statute since the 1970s that restricted rather than expanded the surveillance authority of the intelligence community. You saw the executive branch implementing voluntary changes, particularly in how we did surveillance overseas. And I think the most significant reforms were not legal. You saw the tech companies who had been working secretly to assist the NSA have to become publicly adverse to the NSA. And so I think what James Clapper said was the Snowden revelations accelerated the widespread adoption of encryption by 7 years. And he was saying that to complain. And Snowden would put that on his tombstone. It really made things much, much more secure and required these big tech companies, which were global, to be more adverse to the intelligence state. And look, they present different kinds of threats. We want these powerful entities not to be working together, but to be working against each other. Look, having said that, the core problem that Snowden identified was not surveillance, it was secrecy. It was essentially a problem of democratic governance, where a priesthood, unelected, could use privileges and classification markers to make decisions for all of us without any public approval. We have no idea, really, what has gone on since then. We don't know if Congress has been doing better oversight. We're not seeing public cases. And I think that the irony here is that we need more spectacular acts of lawbreaking. We need them in every micro generation, right? The last time that we had significant surveillance reform before Snowden was in the 1970s. And how did that start? It started with a bunch of anti-war activists breaking into an FBI office outside of Philadelphia and sending all the files to the Washington Post.
That the, the cabal of, I think it was mostly Temple and Haverford University professors breaking into the media PA office on 4th of July weekend, which there's a great book about that. It is an amazing story of like people who had no idea really what they were doing.
The book
in
is called
terms
The Burglar.
Spycraft.
The book is called The Burglars by Betty Metzger, and there's a documentary, if you don't want to read the whole book, called 1971, about this story. But that theft led to the Church Committee hearings, right? A thread kept getting pulled on. And so I think, and this is one of the things that Snowden and I used to gently argue about, is that, he said, we need to come up with enduring solutions to these problems of democratic governance. And I would say there's no such thing. These are only tensions to be managed. And unfortunately, we're going to need the safety valve of whistleblowers. And every, sort of major story in my lifetime about national security started with someone inside the government calling up someone who worked for the media. We wouldn't know about torture prisons. We wouldn't know about rendition. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't know that drone strikes hit the wrong people. We wouldn't know about mass surveillance. We know about those things because someone inside told someone outside and then published a story. And that triggered judicial and congressional oversight.
So it is kind of, we're always going to be in cycles of where the reforms that were done, and this is certainly true of the reforms done in the 70s, which were an absolute attempt by Congress and, in the best of intentions to rein in the surveillance state, you end up, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years later, like, okay, we need a new set of whistleblowers.
What's interesting is that the specific reforms of the 1970s were part of the specific problems in 2013, right?
So that always happens, right?
We created this FISA court, which was a really good idea because before there was no process for this kind of domestic surveillance. And that was okay when the FISA court was doing individualized warrants to go after targeted people. Then all of a sudden you have the FISA court writing 90-page opinions about programmatic surveillance where only one side gets to argue. There's no adversary, in that system, and a court that was designed for one specific purpose ends up being a green light for all of these other kinds of practices that can't survive public scrutiny. So yes, I think that it needs to be refreshed. Now, I want to answer the other part of your question, which is, where are we now, right? I mean, it could in theory be a horseshoe moment where Trump and the MAGA movement also hate the deep state. For reasons real and perceived, they think that Trump was persecuted by it. Is this the time that one of these Patriot Act provisions that, sunsets every year and has to be reauthorized? Is this the time when a bunch of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans might actually get together and defeat this renewal? The last time one of these came before Congress, it was a tie in the House of Representatives. So, we try to stay nimble enough so that we can work with people who agree with us on these issues, even if we disagree on 90% of other issues. But, the Rand Paul caucus in Congress should take this up. And I don't know where this is in the Trump administration.
Yeah.
One of the senior officials in the Trump administration, Sergio Gore, was Rand Paul's chief of staff for a time. So there's at least people in the administration who probably have, you know, views that are similar to ours on reining in some of the worst abuses of national security surveillance.
But of course, it always looks different when you are in charge. Yes. And it seems like Trump, as much as he always runs against the deep state, this time around, he seems to be more in control of his administration. So it might be like, the next guy can get rid of it.
Whatever else you might say about Tulsi Gabbard, she's on record supporting the pardon of Edward Snowden, as is Bobby Kennedy, as was Matt Gaetz, who was almost the attorney general.
Right? Yeah. And Trump floated the idea, at least briefly. Do you have any sense? Two final questions. One is, how is Edward Snowden doing? I mean, this is, his act of heroism, and he's continued to speak out in ways. I've seen a number of his speeches as well as of his writings and posts at X and things like that, which are good. And it also shows he's developing his thought and all of that. But, he's in exile and it does not appear. I mean, is he holding up?
So I do hope people will take a look at his book. If they never have, his book, Permanent Record, which is an extraordinary memoir that addresses a lot of the issues that we're talking about here. And it's amazingly readable. As you say, he's been able to live a public life, in a sense, to participate in the debates that he helped to generate. I mean, this is someone who was prepared to spend his life in prison. Right. What makes an act heroic is that the risk is genuine. The fact that he has been free, that he's not been locked up, that he's not been shut away, that he's not in a maximum security prison subjected to special administrative measures that don't allow him access to the internet or to the public, is itself a way of playing with house money the rest of his life. Look, he's pretty lucky that his longtime girlfriend, who he left in the lurch, went there to join him. Yeah. They got married. They have two young sons. His life is rich. He asks for no sympathy whatsoever. He would prefer to live elsewhere, but it hasn't silenced him. He's been critical of the Russian regime over there.
Like on top of everything, that's like whipped cream and a cherry. I mean, that he won't shut up. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and to the extent that he's retreated a little bit in the last couple of years, he has, like many of us, retreated into family life a little bit. So I don't know. I'm not engaged in back channel conversations with people high up in the Trump administration about what it would take. We've seen part of what it takes, which is, raising money for Trump. This is what Ross Ulbricht and the people around him did, saying a lot of nice things. It's not really Snowden style. When I asked him whether it was really safe for him to be criticizing Putin and the Russian regime, he said, "I didn't do any of this to make friends." It's hard for me to say. Certainly, nothing would be more gratifying for me personally than for the specter of these criminal charges to be dropped, for his contributions to be recognized, and for him to be able to move freely and to choose to live wherever he wants to in the world. He certainly deserves that and more.
Okay, I think we're going to end it there. Ben Wisner of the ACLU, thank you so much for talking today and giving us an update on everything that you guys are doing.
Let's do it again sometime. Thanks, Nick.